Welcome, everyone, joining us here tonight on the Kings County Radio Club's Technical Question and Answer Net. I am Roy, AC2GS, and I will be your net control operator for this informal net. I will be your host, and Bob, KD2NVB, will be my co-host on this exploration into amateur radio technology. The purpose of this net is to provide a platform for discussion and to offer our answers, as well as promote a conversation among all participants of this net. The club maintains an archive of these technical nets on its web pages. We also offer original articles and reviews on many topics covered during these technical nets. We also publish technical puzzles for our participants to ponder and as a starting off point to discuss important technical concepts. Tonight's TechNet puzzle is posted on our club website. The link can be found on the front page of our club's website in orange-colored type, but if you would like a more direct, simple URL to find it, just type into your browser puzzle.kc2rc.com, and that should bring you to our puzzle page. Also, we will be offering a streaming service for those who cannot receive our repeater signal. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. This net is scheduled for the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month. All of this information can also be found on our club website, which is www.kc2rc.com. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we do appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. No question is too simple. No question is dumb. All wisdom begins with the asking of questions. If you have a question, it deserves to be answered. Our format tonight will be to ask for participants to check in only if they have questions or comments for this net. Please give us your name, your first name, your call sign, and whether you have a question or a comment. The net will then address each question in order. I will try to provide a cogent answer, and Bob, KD2NVB, will join in as well. If any other listener has any further facts or opinions, they will be free to break in with the word comment and, when recognized, offer their knowledge or experiences to us all. If anyone has any suggestions for future topics of interest, please let us know either here on the technical net or use our email address, which is tech@kc2rc.com. And now I would like to introduce my co-host for this net, Bob, KD2NVB. Good evening, Bob.
KD2NVB. Good evening, Roy. Good evening, everybody out there. I hope we have a great net tonight. And I'm back to net.
As do I, Bob. Once again, this is AC2GS with the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. So if you have any questions of a technical nature or topics you would like to discuss, or you've discovered something by yourself and would like to share it with us, this is a good opportunity. Hit that push-to-talk button. Give us your first name and your call sign. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month of the year. Since this is the fourth Wednesday of the month, and it's 9:04, we're here for another technical net. But, technical nets need participants. So if you're out there and listening and you have either a topic you'd like to discuss or something that you would like to talk about regarding amateur radio technology or such, or if you have any questions, please hit that push-to-talk button. Give us your first name and your call sign. Well, Bob, it looks like we're going to have a rather short technical net tonight.
Yes, indeed. I don't have anything up my sleeve at the moment. I'll scratch my head and see if I can come up with something.
Okay, well, I'll mention a couple of interesting things. No doubt you heard it from the Limark Technical Net this Sunday night, but because there's very little crossover apparently, I'll mention it for the random people that might actually be listening tonight. There were two interesting technical questions this Sunday night on the Limark Technical Net. A gentleman was complaining he had a radio that worked perfectly fine as long as he kept the transmission levels down. When he peaked it up to anything above 80% power, his receiver would reset itself. So he asked if we had any bright ideas on how he could test different things. And the general consensus was that other than something esoteric that would probably require a technician, he should address two possible problems, primarily the power supply. If you have a problem with the power wire itself, where for some odd reason there's a little bit corrosion and increased resistance, as you increase the power, you can increase the heat, and that will increase the resistance even more and might cause a failure. More likely, there's something wrong in the guy's power supply proper, that when you try to summon more than enough amps, more than a certain amount of amps, the power regulation fails for one reason or another. The voltage drops and reaches a point that the electrical circuitry just will not tolerate such low voltages, and that could lead to a reset. And on the transmitter side, it is theoretically possible that he's getting a lot of RF into his shack, and at one point, when the power is above 80%, it gets into the CPUs and such and causes a crash and a hard reset. So we suggested that he try swapping power supplies, swapping power supply wires, and also trying a dummy load for his transmitter to lessen the chance of RF getting into his CPU and such. So that was one person. Another person had a curious problem. He had a old and trustworthy, he thought, dummy load with a watt meter attached. And he had checked the dummy load. You can check a dummy load with a voltmeter. Although dummy loads are usually used for RF purposes, by definition, they're supposed to be non-inductive pure resistances, so that they are one-to-one standing wave ratio impedance matched across the bandwidth. So he checked it with a voltmeter, and he says he got a resistance of greater than 60 ohms, supposed to be 50 ohms. I thought he was going to then ask how he might replace the resistor or put in a parallel resistor to balance it back to 50 ohms of nominal non-inductive reactance. But instead, he asked how he could tweak his watt meter so that it would be more accurate with a 60-ohm load since it had been designed for a 50-ohm load. So we discussed that. For the most part, my assessment was he should probably look more to fixing the dummy load, since the importance of a watt meter was dubious if you weren't feeding it into a one-to-one standing wave ratio dummy load. Once you veer off that, so now he has something that's basically a 1:1.2 standing wave ratio. That will tell you the watts of outputted if you don't match your antenna system. Most of us want to match our antenna system. So those are a little short version of what went on with the technical aspect of this Sunday's Limark Technical Net, which I would suggest if you are interested in technical nets, you might want to listen to as well as this one. Anyway. Once again, this is AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We're here on the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month. So if anyone out there remembers the Technical Net and would like to either ask a question or bring up a topic or make a comment, please hit that push-to-talk button.
NVV.
Yes, Bob, I heard you, a tail end of your comment. What was the beginning of it?
I just said my call sign. I said KD2MVB. By the way, how's my signal? I had it at full power when I first talked to you a few minutes ago. Now it's at half power because I had problems getting into the repeater yesterday, so I'm wondering how it is today at half, at 50%, which is 20 watts. I mean, 25 watts.
Sounds fine. I'm giving it 25 watts myself right now. Interesting little story I'll share with you, since not many other questions coming up. Recently, I had my antennas tweaked. My fan dipole had been a mess lately. But as part of that, I decided to try and get a 10-element Yagi pointed at Limark because their repeater is having problems. I have to throw 150 watts of power at Limark for them to hear me. So I got this nice little diamond 10-element Yagi. And the problem is, though, that the best position to point it at is right across the street. I have an 8-story co-op apartment house. And that gives me the best signal. But since the signal has to go through an entire apartment complex, it attenuates the signal such that it's no better than my Comet GP6 or GP3. And plus, because of the gamma match that's used for that Yagi, it has a 50-watt maximum full-duty use. So I can't use my linear amplifier to blast the signal at 150 watts. So now I have an extra Yagi. And just out of curiosity, I thought I would try it out as Kings County Radio Club's, I have a radio that's pretty much dedicated to streaming it on the internet. And the signal is quite nice. So apparently the Kings County Radio Club's repeater is pretty much in line with the general direction of my shack to Limark. So I'm able to use it for Kings County Radio Club. I'm able to pick up bits and pieces of Long Island. I have it also listening to the 70-centimeter Limark repeater. So that's my Yagi story for the week.
Great, Roy. I actually have my own story. I actually do have a question, really, because I was on, well, Limark, I had to throw all my watts. I'm closer to Kings County than you are. I'm closer to Limark as well, but maybe not. I'm in a funny location to Limark with Park Slope. But anyway, Gwen, yesterday I went on the Tuesday net at Kings County, and I had to turn up, well, I was at 40% power, and they said my signal was bad, so I went all the way up to 100%. But then later on receive, I was listening to Self, and he's doing these quiz, you know, he's doing those trivia questions, and he kept saying one, and he kept, at the end of the question, every time it would start breaking up, and I thought it was something on his end. It always happened in the same word. But then later, my whole receive started breaking up. It was crazy. I had to shut it down and switch to my HT. Right now it's fine. But, yeah, I don't know. It was very strange. This particular problem had never happened to me before on any repeater or any kind of radio. So I don't know what it is. So I guess that's not enough to give you to you to take a guess either. But I guess it's something I'm just going to have to see if it happens again. Back to you.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different reasons for it, possibly. I doubt that it would be a power supply issue if you have problems with the receive, because, you know, it's negligible, the amount of power. So it might be something overheating in the radio proper that's kind of detuning some discrete components. A lot of different things affect propagation. I had problems at a time. I have, as I mentioned, I have two Comet antennas. I have a GP3 and a GP6. The GP6 is the tallest one. It's in the middle of my roof. The GP3 is on a laundry pole at the corner of my backyard, which usually is decent. About a year or two ago, I was using it for this 7100. And was having weird problems with Kings County, which I finally figured out was because a large tree of my neighbors had overgrown all over the place, and all the water in the leaves were acting as blocks, so that I wasn't barely able to hear the received signals. Rain can affect UHF, VHF too, weather conditions, all kinds of little propagation problems. Recently, we've had a case of tropospheric ducting. I've been hearing stations that I usually don't hear. I mentioned on Limark that I heard a station in Pennsylvania that had Limark's frequency, using the same frequency. And, you know, in Brooklyn, I could hear him. Paul, who was up in farther up in Long Island and might have been listening to Selden's repeater, for all I know, didn't hear it at all. So there's a lot of different reasons why propagations can go in and out. I hope it's not a hardware problem. You'll have to kind of figure it out as time goes on. The fact that you're receiving fine and transmitting fine on lower power today, it tends to be a good sign, but it's always good to know exactly why it didn't work the last time.
Right. I mean, if it never happens again, I'll just won't think about it until it does happen again. But I do know that when I transmitted to you on Limark last Sunday, and the thing started, and I had to go to full power then too, and it started beeping, and you said it might be overheating, but it was not saying overheat on my thing. It was just doing, I think, because I have to do this. I never got around to fixing this plug on my microphone, so I'm sitting here holding it in with my hand when I talk, and I think my thumb or something may have touched the touch screen, because it just said something like I was going into a menu or going to that thing where you change the bands you're on with all the grid of the rectangles with the different bands, but it was beeping. But I don't know, when it beeps, is it supposed to, you think it would put a little thing saying overheating, but maybe it doesn't. And I don't know, and that happened maybe once last night too, the beeping. And the same thing with that funny screen, it had nothing to do with looking like an error message. It was just like I inadvertently entered into a menu or something. Anyway, I don't know if any of this is connected or not. Back to you.
Okay, well, you know, I mean, it's not that difficult. ICOMs are unfortunately notorious for overheating. The ICOM 7100 is much better with heat dissipation than the previous 7000 model, which a lot of people were complaining of. They'd like the 7000, but it almost invariably overheated because of the poor thermal conductivity, you know, the way they arranged everything. And, you know, FEB is a 100% duty cycle transmission. It's not like single sideband or CW or anything. So it's problematic. I don't know about your location. Again, in my location, in the edge of good old Brooklyn near Coney Island, I have to smack the repeater silly because of their temporary antenna, which they have yet to find the rigor to swap out the temporary with the permanent. So I have to throw anywhere near 150 watts to be heard. So the fact that you can be heard on full power with just the 7100 is much better than my situation these days.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely am physically closer than you are, but I people used to say that this area was bad for other reasons, like, I don't know, some obstruction or something. But when their antenna is good, I can even hit Limark at, I don't know, 40 or 30, even 30% power, 25 possibly. I didn't try to test it how far it could go down, but I know it could do it. It used to do it at 30% a lot, and I was at 40. I was at 40 last Sunday when you couldn't hardly hear me, and I went to 100. I didn't want to mess around. So I know their repeater's worse. It seems like it's a little hard to hit Kings County as well. I don't know what that's about.
Oh, I haven't heard that as a problem. I assume I'm full quieting using 50% of the power. That should be about 25 watts. In the old days, I could hit Limark easily with 18 watts.
Yeah, you're fine. And in fact, even yesterday when I when this thing started doing all that breaking up, I switched to my HT, and I didn't even have time to hook up to a mag mount with all that stuff, but I just threw it. I just left its ham stick antenna on. I just went and stood next to my window, and Selvin could hear me. But I think he was. He said my signal was scratchy, but I think he was probably talking about my HT signal. So it was probably scratchy, but this is 5 watts on a ham stick standing indoors, even though I'm next to a window. So I can hit it with 5 watts, but maybe not really really well. So you're full quieting, and I assume I am too.
Yes, indeed, you're full quieting. Also, what kind of popped into my head is, have you tightened up the connections? Some connectors invariably loosen over time, so it's always a good practice every so often going over the connectors and giving them a little bit of a tug.
Well, I just quickly, later last night after the net, I just checked the back of my 7100 to see, you know, the coax was not loose. I checked the tightness of that. That's all I did. But the other thing I have is, I have two mag mounts that are identical. These, I think you might have recommended them. Probably it's a Diamond, I think. It's either Diamond or Comet. And it was the highest rated one of that type on EHAM with a lot of ratings. Anyway, I got two of them. So if it's the antenna, that's enough. If I have a problem again, I'll just swap the antennas and see if one of the antennas is better than the other, which might mean a problem. So, but I just checked the back of my radio to see if the coax was tight, and it was.
Okay, very good. I mean, that's usually not too much of a problem with UHF connectors. I really dislike SMA connectors. I don't know how much experience you've had with them. I've had way too much experience with them. Just by concentrating on the brass, you can loosen the darn things. It got to a point where I invested in a torque wrench specifically for SMA connectors, and I haven't yet decided whether that really helps that much.
The SMA, that's the default one on most of these HTs, I believe. And I have the SMA to BNC adapter on my, well, the handy talkie I use is the, yes, the Fusion one that I use for the Fusion net and all that, you know, the ASU2D. And so the only, yeah, SNA, but the adapter seems, I think it's tight. And I love BNC, because we can just switch in and out.
AC2GS. Yes, I pretty much as soon as I buy any handy talkie, I will put one of those SMA to BNC adapters, and I have a whole slew of different whip and little bullet antennas that are BNC that I can just swap in and out in a fraction of a second. I use the very, very small rubber duckies, mostly for my hotspot handy talkies, and I can swap them out for a full-size whip if I have to when I go outside. So I'm a big fan of the SMA to BNC converters. I would never go back to having to sit there and screw SMA connectors on and off to change antennas anymore.
Yeah, me too. I got even my very first HT, which is that glorified Baofeng. It's the B-Tech, Baofeng Tech. They're maybe a little notch above Baofeng. It costs about $60, and it's a tri-bander. And it actually has a better speaker than the 2D. And I actually, it has the reverse, they reversed the male-female thing with the SMA, and I actually got an adapter for that so I can throw my BNC antennas on. So I should be using that radio once in a while. Like, if I use it on an analog, I should try it instead of this one, instead of my 2D. Anyway, right now I'm using my 7100. Back to you.
Yeah, I have the BNC connectors for both the regular SMA and the reverse SMA. I don't exactly know why they decided to do that with the reverse SMA. I assume they just got a big supply of them. They're very popular for Wi-Fis and such. So I don't know. Just to add a little bit more confusion to the hobby, Baofeng did that. But I have both flavors of SMA to BNC, and I have them pretty much on, I think, all my handy talkies. So it's one of those handy little suggestions that when it's passed around, I've never heard anyone say, yeah, I tried it, but it didn't work for me. It seems to be one of those great ideas that unfortunately not everyone has heard yet about.
Yeah, the other reason I have it is because the reason Well, I have two mag mounts. Originally, because I left one at my aunt's house, and I didn't visit her again for several months, so I just bought another one rather than asking my 80-something-year-old aunt and uncle to dig it up and mail it to me. And I got two of them, and I use one of them for my HT. When I want to go out on the HT, I can just hook it up through my pigtail adapter, and I just pop it right on, and you can, just like all those others, I can switch it on and off real fast to the other antennas.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I have a pigtail adapter, too. In the old days, before I got an FTM 400 to monitor Kings County, I was using an FT2DR, and I would have a little pigtail connected through the BNC. So they're very, very useful. You have to understand what you're using and the strains and the physical stresses, because, unfortunately, if you don't know what you're doing, where you don't really respect what you're doing, you're going to rip the SMA connector right off the damn handy-talky. And that's an expensive fix, unfortunately.
Yeah, I bet it would be. A Baofeng, it might cost more than just buying another Baofeng. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the beauty of Baofengs, I've always, you know, I don't disdain them. I think they're wonderful entry-level radios, and they make great disposable radios. If you're going to be in a very, very physically haphazard environment and you don't want to risk a $400 handy-talky, you know, springing for a $25 handy-talky, you know, if you drop it in the ocean, so what? You buy another one. You know, unfortunately, I know some people who kind of took that to an absurd degree, and they bought themselves almost a dozen Baofengs. I don't understand the need for a dozen Baofengs. I don't quite know the reason for more than one Baofeng, actually, but, you know, whatever floats your boat. But, yeah, with Baofengs, you know, I think if anything happened to a Baofeng, I would just throw it away and buy another Baofeng. But again, you have things like the FT2DR, you have other companies, ICOM makes, $400 handy-talkies. So, you know, you pop the SMA off of those things, it's probably something like $150 to have it fixed. And then you got to kind of figure whether it pays or it doesn't pay, and you know, you pays your money. So everyone out there, understand that SMA connectors are nice, but they don't have a lot of strain relief built into them. So don't force them with too many newtons of force, or else you'll get a bill.
Yeah, a bill for more than a bill. Yeah, true. Yeah, I like my old Baofeng. I should use it again. It was like a whopping $60 radio. It was the tri-bander, and it actually had the speaker, it's a 1-watt audio amplifier, which I think the 2D only has a 0.7 watt or something in that neighborhood, and it probably sounds a little better.
Okay, you bought the deluxe version. It's sort of like the deluxe version of the Yugo. I just bought, I think it was a B5 as opposed to a UV5, which I think almost all of them, except for the tri-banders, are basically the same exact radio in a slightly different chassis.
Yeah, this one's made by this company called Baofeng Tech, and one thing you can do is order them. They're in the States instead of in China or something. Maybe other people are too, but I looked it up. They were very reputable, and some people thought they kind of maybe added a little extra quality. I think they take the Baofeng parts and then kind of assemble them or something. But also they beefed up, because this one's a tri-bander, which was nice. That's the one reason I got it. I said, well, what the heck? I did some research, you know, before, this is even before I had my license, you know. I bumped into some guy at a computer thing that had a Baofeng. I said, oh, that'd be cool, $30. But I just did a little research, and I ended up buying this one for a little more. It's still pretty cheap.
Okay. I mean, I have mine sitting on a shelf someplace. I don't think I've turned it on in about 5 years. Again, it's my disposable radio. You know, if I'm going to go into a war zone, I guess I would take something like that. I don't know. But yeah, they're fine. There was a time around the beginning of things like Baofeng. Before everyone learned about Baofeng, there was a Waxon and other people called it a Woshin, and it's still being sold. It's at about twice to two and a half times the prices of Baofengs. And there was a flood of the market of identical radios with different brands. It took everyone about an hour and a half to figure out that it was the same bunch of guys just rebranding the stuff all over the place. And thankfully that ended, because it was getting, you know, it's bad enough these unpronounceable Chinese brands, you know, when each company manufactures under 10 different brands, it led to a heck of a lot of confusion on everyone's part.
Yes, it reminds me of these, you might be aware of these camera lenses like Samyang and, a few of them, Rokinon, and they're all the same thing. And they're actually good quality lenses, but they're, the caveat is they're manual focus. But, so I don't know, I shied away from their 85mm 1.4 that was like $300 instead of the usual $1,000 or something like that, because I didn't think I could focus at 1.4 with virtually no depth of field. But I got their 8mm fisheye, because who the heck needs autofocus for that? So it reminds me of that. There are like several different brand names for these lenses. It's the same thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of that in China in general. There are companies that manufacture items but do not want to support it under any circumstance. So they will enter into some kind of strange relationship with different people on different areas of the globe and brand it to their brand, and the third party has the warranty responsibilities. And China just manufactures them, slaps on the brand that the buyer wants them to slap it on, and they're sold. There's a big company, Godox, that makes lighting equipment for photography, and it's just like that. Godox is the brand name in the United States. If you go to England, it's sold under a different brand name with a different importer and different warranty services, and it's just the way they like to do business. Being far away and speaking a different language, it's not cost effective for them to deal with warranties, I guess. So you got a lot of these rebranding. It's the same exact model. I mean, you could put them next to each other and you couldn't tell the difference except for the name on the cover.
So it's something to do with the warranty, the reason they changed these names or something. Wonder if we should check to see if there's anybody out there with a question.
Yes, indeed. That would be very nice. I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. If anyone out there has any questions or topics for discussion about amateur radio or statements to make about things that they've discovered or would like to share, please hit that push-to-talk button. Give me your first name and your call sign. Okay, I definitely do have to get that cricket sound effects worked into this thing. It's probably not that difficult since everything's hooked up to my computers anyway. Oh, well, what can I tell you? Some lenses are very, very nice. There are some lenses where you really, thankfully, don't need autofocusing. I have a couple of macro lenses where, you know, you really can't do much with autofocusing. You have to just bite the bullet and do it yourself. So I have some LAO, I think, L-A-O macro lenses, which have, you know, pretty good specs, but they are manual focus.
Yeah, most of them. So I do wonder, I mean, I have a Pentax, I mean, I have a Pentax system, and so I have a Pentax 100mm macro lens. It's an older model, but it is autofocus, but like you say, most of the time you don't use it. Though if it did it well enough, I might want to use it for like trying to catch a bee buzzing around a flower or something like that. I'd have to have very good autofocus. Might be harder than flying birds, since they don't even go in one direction. They just kind of go all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, I have a Sony camera, and I have a 90mm macro lens. The problem, though, is when you get really, really up close, the depth of field is so minuscule that the electronics doesn't have the faintest idea what you want to put into focus. Just aiming, not that it's designed for insect eyes. The Sony is designed for mostly human eyes. They can do animal eyes as well. But with very small objects like an insect, it wouldn't know what to focus on. It would probably breathe all over the place.
Right. The good B shots I've gotten, and you have to shoot a lot to get a couple, though I got a new camera that has definitely better autofocus for moving things like that. Like, I'm itching to try it out. But I didn't use a macro lens for it. I used like a pretty long telephoto at least 300 millimeters so I could be far enough away that I didn't scare the bee away and shoot a lot of shots. And then out of a whole lot of shots, I get a couple that I actually got the guy in focus.
Well, how telephoto is it? Because I think I have a macro. My longest macro is 100 millimeters.
This is not a macro. It's just a pretty long telephoto, and I can still get close enough. In fact, I was doing it with this. This is a 55 to 300 zoom, so it's not even a. I mean, I have a fancier, bigger, heavier 300 millimeter f/4 lens. That's just a prime, but I was using the zoom, and I had a teleconverter on it. That I threw away, but so it wasn't a macro, but I'm not getting that close, but it was close enough for that, because it was, that gives me 420 millimeters at that point on an APS-C camera.
Okay, that's a way of going. If you use I used to have telephotos that were vaguely close to that. I haven't in years. They're just way too big and heavy, and you put the extenders on, and it stops down really to a small f-stop. I don't know. I found it very cumbersome.
Well, for birding, I use my 300 f/4, which is about 2.5 pounds, and I put the converter on the 1.4 converter, so it's now a 420 f/5.6, which is still not, a decent aperture. And that's for birding, and I use one of those really nice straps that go across your body, and it makes it a whole lot more comfortable to carry a heavy rig. And I go on bird walks that lasted 6 hours, and plus I'm wearing a backpack with my lunch and my water and other stuff in it. And it's not that bad, and that's a fairly light rig for birding, because I'm reading a book about serious bird photographers get lenses much heavier than that, and that's considered a fairly light lens for those guys, the serious guys. So back to you.
Yeah, I mean the price and the weight and the aperture size goes up for the professionals. Both animal and sports tends to use the same type of equipment as well. Also, you probably have the benefit of boosting the image on the display, since you have a digital. Well, I would assume your display is through a penta mirror, right? It's not a electronic viewfinder display, is it?
No, it's an SLR. It's Bentax is the one company that's sort of sticking with the DSLRs, and they are the ones invented the penta prism in, I think, the 50s. And yeah, it's better than a penta. Penta mirror is a lower quality, cheaper version of that. I don't know the technical difference, but anyway, it's penta prism, but it is a mirror. You know, it's a mirror kind of thing. And yeah, so that's the the newest cameras that's supposed to be the best for this action kind of autofocus are these mirrorless things. Evidently, there's something about mirrorless that they have this, somehow they can do things that a DSLR can't. I don't know the technical stuff why, but it seems to be a fact because everybody in the forum says it. And there's a guy that goes on my bird walks who has a Sony A1, you know, that $6,500 top of the line for birding, you know, so that's what some people use. I still like the optical viewfinder though for the actual experience of when you're taking the pictures.
Okay, you know, whatever you find the best for your purposes. Different people have different preferences. Sometimes it's due to what they trained on, what they used before. It's probably easier with an electronic viewfinder because the electronic viewfinder, usually the ones I'm familiar with, even have a selection in the menu that they can take a very, very low-level lit area because you're using a small aperture and extenders and such, and it can boost the image so that it'll look like a bright image even though you're fully stopped down. So part of that also, they have usually more sophisticated phase detection of focus and such. So, you know, as time goes on, the resolution of the viewfinders will get denser and denser, and it'll be kind of difficult for anyone to really tell the difference between an optical viewfinder and an electronic one, except for all the extra information that's embedded in the viewfinder's image.
Yeah, when it gets to that point, I may switch, but, you know, I looked through your camera when it was new, a year and a half ago, and, yeah, it was pretty cool, but I still, at that stage, I still prefer an optical. But it was a lot better than the ones I'd looked through in, you know, many years earlier, of course. But I understand that it can do a lot of things. Like, for instance, I have the one I use for birding that I just got is an APS-C. It's kind of, I prefer that because it reaches farther with the same telephoto lens. But, and it's got enough pixels. But I have a full frame. If you shoot in crop mode on a full frame with an optical viewfinder, you can't see what you're doing as well because all of a sudden there's this small rectangle in the middle of the viewfinder that's, you know, less than half of the area, and that's what your photo is. I'm guessing that a mirrorless could probably make it fill the whole viewfinder even if it was a full frame and you were using it in crop mode. I would think they'd be able to do that, so that's probably another advantage.
Yeah, that's exactly what they do. They just zoom into it. So, yeah. I don't know. Again, whatever floats one's boat. There are guys out there who don't really like the things like my software-defined radio. They don't like computer screens on their radio. They like knobs and dials like the good old days. And, you know, if that's what makes them happy, then congratulations. Go with it. People change when they need to change and when they want to change. And the newest, shiniest thing is not always the best thing. Every so often, I will upgrade some system and unfortunately figure out that someone's cheaped out or tried to use some new technology that isn't quite ready for prime time. So it's a painful experience living on the bleeding edge.
Oh, one thing I wanted to correct, I guess I'm correcting, because I think you were saying that looking through like an SLR, you're looking through it stopped down. You're not. The optical viewfinders, they always show, when you're looking at the thing you're photographing, it's always, the lens is always wide open. It shuts it down to whatever aperture you picked at the very last, you know, instant before it takes the picture. You have to do that thing with the, what do they call it, depth of field preview, which you push the switch in a certain direction on most of these cameras, and then all of a sudden, I never found those very useful. I've tried it on my new cameras. It always seemed like all of a sudden it's so dark I can't really tell what the depth of field is anymore. So I never used that very much. I'll have to try it again. But yeah, it's a bright. In fact, my new camera has an exceptionally bright viewfinder. It doesn't matter where it's, if it's on F32, I'm still seeing it at F28 if it's a 2.8 lens when I'm looking at the thing right before I take the photo.
Oh, yeah, I realize that. I mean, it depended also on the cheapness of the lens. In the olden days, there were lenses like nowadays, there are lenses that are manual focus. Back in the good old days, all of them were manual focus. And the cheap lenses didn't have one of those rods that that opened up the iris for focusing and such and just closed it while it was taking a picture. So you had some cheap lenses that just had a aperture ring, and you selected the aperture ring, and that was the aperture. And also, you know, if you went for inexpensive telephotos and then used the extender, the aperture would shrink down significantly so that, you know, it wasn't the most fun in the world trying to focus on a dimly lit image.
Right. That's what I promised depth of field treatment. You know, I haven't tried it since. It was my first DSLR camera, which was back in 2006. I haven't tried it. I should try it because maybe they've improved that a lot. Or the viewfinder on this new camera is probably a lot better than it was 15 years ago on that one. But when I do depth of field preview, everything was so dark, I really couldn't tell what was in focus and what wasn't.
Yeah, I mean, that was a very big problem. Matter of fact, if you remember, there were cameras that you could swap out the focus piece of glass, so that there were certain technologies of little micro prisms to use to focus under low light conditions, and people would swap them out if they were going to use very, very small aperture lenses.
Right, you're talking about those display screens, like especially when everybody was using manual focus because there was no autofocus. And I remember like they had some little thing in the middle, like a circle, that was supposed to, like, the things would be out of alignment, the little segments of the image, and they'd line up when you got it in focus, things like that, I guess.
Yeah, but they had, in some models, they had interchangeable versions of that, so that the primary focus guide was the split level, where you'd see a circle, and there'd be a line, and you would line up objects from the lower part of the half circle to the upper part of the half circle. And that usually required some degree of decent lighting. In some models of Nikons and Canons, you could open up the, take off the detachable lens, put a tweezer inside, pull that focusing guide out, and swap it in for something with a whole string of micro prisms that were said to be a little bit easier to get a focus on low illumination.
I didn't know about that specific one, but I do know that they had ways you could buy alternate screens, so people just had different preferences, and they would change to a different type of focusing screen. I think some of the DSLRs could do that, too. I don't know if these you can do that now on these modern ones or not. Maybe some you can. I don't know.
I would think not. They may still be available on the professional premium if they're still making them. I haven't checked lately if Nikon is still selling a lot of, I guess, their F1s. Again, nowadays with phase detection sensors on the mirrorless, it's a bit of history, but nothing more than that these days.
Right, I guess, yeah, because my screen, I can do different settings. If I want to, some people like to see that kind of rule of thirds grid on their screen, other people don't. I got a few of those options for my cameras, but it's just for visual. I mean, of course, they assume everything's autofocus, and so if you're going to manual focus now, in some ways it's harder because they don't assume you're manual focusing, so they don't give you those guides anymore.
Yeah, again, a lot of things you'll find in the photographic museum. If you ever travel to Long Island, I think there's a Nikon building still around there. I bought a microscope for medical school back in the 80s, late 70s. There. So it's probably still there with a lot of great historical models out there.
Right. I had a Canon AE-1 that I bought in 1981, and I got rid of it a few years ago. I wasn't using it. If I ever get film, I'd probably find an old Pentax K1000, because now I have all these Pentax lenses, and you can actually put old Pentax lenses on new Pentax digital cameras, and that's what I happen to have now. So Anyway, yeah, I remember that Canon 81, and my eyes were better in those days, too. There was no autofocus, and I had better eyes for manual focusing when I was, you know, that much younger.
Ah, yes, we were all young ones. I had a Canon A1, a very nice camera, loved it dearly. I had a bunch of interchangeable lenses for it, and didn't go through that much film because, you know, film was kind of expensive. Did darkroom stuff myself, black and white, never did color.
Well, I think color darkroom, not too many people got into that. That was just much more difficult, I think.
Well, it depends. I kind of worked my way up. My parents had a old style, I think it was called a 620 film format. It was about 2.25 by 2.25 negatives. So if you weren't that much of a, you know, obsessive compulsive, you didn't even need an enlarger. So when I was a little kid, I bought some chemicals from a photography company, you know, retail place. Some fixer and developer and stop bath and set up a little dark room in my basement bathroom because we had the plumbing. And then for some reason I decided to expand and I bought myself an enlarger, moved it to another room in the basement, and had air filters and safety lights and all kind of fun stuff. I had endless dodged and burned and made my own 8x10s and such. It was loads of fun. It was, you know, just as radios have this kind of magical quality to me of these invisible waves that travel all over the place, seeing an image slowly become itself in the developer bath just amazed me. It was a magic trick to me.
Right. For a long time I wished I had done darkroom, but I never did. I had my grandfather, the guy that was a physicist, he also had a hobby of doing darkroom. He had a Leica, and he had his darkroom, and he made all these prints of, you know, we lost a lot of those pictures in a flood. My parents' basement, but I think there was still some survived. He took lots of pictures, you know, black and white pictures of my mother and my aunt when they were children in the 1930s and 40s and all stuff like that. And the places they went, and that place they spent in Minnesota, their island, and this that I saw much later, but seeing it 50 years earlier or something, that was pretty much of a kick.
AC2GS. Yeah, it's sort of a shame that, you know, there's no way to kind of keep them in front of you for the long term. They inevitably get put in boxes. The boxes get put into basements. The basements flood, and that's the end of that. I still have a whole bunch of contact prints and the negatives and some 8.5 by 10 black and whites that I particularly liked and held on to. I kind of wish that I had been able to try color. I just couldn't budget something like that when I was really into the darkroom, because color was a couple of orders of magnitude more expensive than black and white. And, you know, something like Cibachrome. I always lusted after being able to do Cibachrome prints.
What exactly is Cibachrome? I've heard of that, but I don't remember or maybe never knew what it is exactly.
It was, I believe, a German chemistry manufacturer of color film. Instead of using Kodak dyes, they used what usually was believed to be a bit richer dye color. So you had a bit more vibrant color tone than the general color pictures of the day. People used to like to use that to print Kodachrome slides.
Okay, so the slides were originally, the film was made for Kodachrome processing, I guess, but they did Cibachrome processing and it still worked.
It was one of the few color chemistries that the manufacturer marketed to individuals. Kodak was kind of more in the industrial color printing arena. than the Germans. You know, it was interesting. There was a whole bunch of places. Ilford in the United Kingdom had a major film industry. Of course, Fuji made Japanese film. I'm not quite sure if they exist at all. I know what happened, unfortunately, to Kodak. And some of the people who bought Kodak at the very end for its name are probably busy talking to lawyers because of that scam that they pulled last year, where they were going to pull, I think it was vaccinations out of their backside, having no knowledge of medical technology at all. You know, they were very good at film chemistry, but at least the people who used to own it, not the people who presently own it.
So there's going to be a Kodak COVID vaccine? The other thing, Fuji's still around making digital cameras. I guess you know that, right? I know they make mirrorless. Maybe they make, no one seems to be making DSLRs anymore except maybe Pentax and maybe a couple of Nikon. Anyway, yeah, so Kodak was making, was trying to make a vaccine? Is that what you said?
There was some major political scam where they apparently got approval for a couple of billion dollars from the government to bankroll development of turning it into some kind of major pharmaceutical company because they dealt with chemicals at one point. About a week and a half before the announcement, the president bought a bunch of Kodak stock, which was obviously insider trading, and a couple of politicians did as well, and just the whole darn thing blew up on all of them.
So you mean, was it some kind of a fraud thing, or just Kodak did this thing and then it just crashed because not enough people bought into it, or I'm not clear?
Well, I don't want to allude upon this as being complete fraud, but a company that has no expertise in a field gets offered billions of dollars as seed money to develop expertise in a field that they have no expertise for, and then a bunch of people related with that deal try to flip stock prices on the basis of that. So my guess is a couple of people are going to end up spending a few years in federal penitentiaries.
Wow, so there are charges against some of these people, these politicians or whoever that bought into this thing, or you mean the people that set it up, or both?
I think principally it's the president of the new Kodak company that basically is getting slammed. Dunked. If he takes other people with him, I guess that depends upon what kind of a deal he makes with people. You know, law, you know, suits and such go very, very slowly. So, you know, it could probably be years. I haven't heard anything about where this court case was going. But at the very beginning, it was a very, very loud crash when they you know, the federal government said, did we offer billions of dollars? Gee, I wonder why we did that. No, we're not going to give them billions of dollars. So they kind of are playing, you know, they're playing deja vu. They're playing that they have amnesia or something. So the president of Kodak, or at least the ex-president of Kodak, is probably going to pay for most of these shenanigans.
Wow, I don't think I heard about that case. This is like had to be in the last year or so. It was about COVID. I missed that one.
Yeah, it was. I think it was kind of like the very early months, you know, when people were antsy, but they weren't quite sure. And they had lined up pharmaceutical companies, but they wanted to hedge their bets. I think that was the general tenor of the situation back then. You know, that was the time where they were giving idiots who had no way of getting masks millions of dollars up front to secure access to the masks that they didn't have any access to.
Yeah, some kind of general panicky stuff.
Yes, indeed. Ah, the good old days. Anyway, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy. This is the Kings County Radio Club Technical Net. We usually discuss amateur radio here, but we're talking amongst ourselves. If anyone out there has any questions of a technical nature or topic that they'd like to hear discussed, please hit the push to talk button and give us a question or a comment. Oh, well, I think we have a very, 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 very slow night tonight. I think what we'll do is we'll mothball the TechNet puzzle for the next episode, just as, because it's us, the two of us. What do you think, Bob?
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea to me. Otherwise, you're just asking me the question, and either I know the answer or I don't. It's probably not what you had in mind.
Yeah. Oh, well, we filled an hour, the two of us. I thank you for the company. Once again, next Wednesday, when we have our club meeting, I will repeatedly mention that it would be a nice thing if club members would attend net functions, and we'll see what happens.
Yes, indeed, Roy. Oh, my God, the thing's happening again. It's beeping. But it lights, I think my, anyway, I think it's fine. Yeah, I just wanted to say that I won't make the next meeting next week because I got a gig for that day, August 4th, playing out in Manhattan. So I won't be there, but I will follow what's going on.
Okay, very good. Well, you will be missed, Bob, but I hear the beeping coming back. It's very reminiscent of this past Sunday.
But it's the same thing. When it beeps, it's a screen that comes on. I think it's just because I hit, let me just try doing this, touching the touch screen with, yeah, that beep right there was because I touched the screen, and it's that thing where you want to switch bands, and it's that grid of rectangles that I can go to the, you know, all the different bands that this radio has, which is like all of the main ones, HF, etc. And that beep, and then I hit the beep.
Have you tried the lock button? I'm not quite sure if the lock button locks the touch screen, but it's worth a try. Bob, this is AC2GS. I mentioned trying the lock button to see if that helps. I haven't heard you since then. Oh, well, I hope nothing bad happened to Bob or Bob's radio, as the saying goes, and then there was one. This net has been brought to you by the Kings County Radio Club. Our club is an ARRL-affiliated club based in Brooklyn, New York. We meet on the first Wednesday of each month. Our next meeting will be August 4th, which will be held by teleconference. Club members will be emailed with the details of logging into the meeting. Non-members wishing to join a general meeting can email me for the required link. Keep in mind that you have to identify yourself. You can't go by some anonymous thing and give me an email address that's something like thesenuts99, you got to be legit. Anyway, although our meetings informally begin after 7 p.m., our formal regular general meeting starts at 8 p.m. and continues until anywhere from 9 p.m. to 10 p.m., depending upon the number of points that are covered. We have a weekly 2-meter club net on every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. on this repeater, and a weekly net featuring Yaesu's Fusion Digital Technology every Thursday night at 9 p.m. You can connect to our repeater while in Fusion Digital mode either directly using a Fusion Digital Technology radio or by using a hotspot in some other digital technology mode using our network gateways such as our XLX server or our TGIF server or our QuadNet server. We offer an audio stream of the FusionNet on the Internet as well as all audio transmissions on our club repeater. Just point your browser to stream.kc2rc.com. This technical net meets on the second and fourth Wednesday of each month at 9 p.m. We also sponsor a 10-meter net every Sunday morning at 11 a.m. on 28.380 upper sideband. Members as well as non-members are welcome to participate, although we'd appreciate it when our fellow hams join our club. And as always, an application is readily available on our club's website. If you would like to contact the host of this TechNet, simply address your email to tech@kc2rc.com. We maintain an active website at www.kingscountyradioclub.com or www.kc2rc.com, which offers archives of this technical net, amateur radio news, original articles, and technical forums. Please visit our website and participate. Our website services were generously donated by the local Brooklyn-based web hosting company, Three Aliens Web Hosting, who we would like to thank. As the great philosopher Jimi Hendrix once said, knowledge speaks but wisdom listens, so try to listen a bit more and talk a bit less. So we're going to roll this up and shut it down, but we'll be back to do it all over again August 11th. And you're all welcome to join us, especially the people who haven't joined us tonight. Thanks to everyone who participated tonight, which means Bob, KD2NVB. Without you, I'd be talking to myself. So this is AC2GS, and I'll be going clear and getting the heck out of here. Be safe, people, if you're listening to me, and come back next time. This is AC2GS clear.
Great two-person net, Roy. Nice chat. So I'm hoping more people will come next time. 73s.